Hello and welcome to Dermatology Snapshots. My name is Zainab Jad and I'm joined today by my colleague Leila Ferguson in presenting our August 2023 edition. So we've had a short break over summer and we've got a great collection of practice impacting papers to present today. So we're going to kick off with a paper that we've been keenly awaiting the results of. So this is Effectiveness of Spironolactone for Women with Acne Vulgaris, SAFA in England and Wales. And this is a pragmatic, multi-centre, phase 3, double-blind, randomised controlled trial. So why do we choose this paper? Well, spironolactone is increasingly used for acne, but good data from large RCTs is lacking. So we feel this paper will provide important evidence to support its use. So this was a pragmatic, multi-centre, double-blind study. Patients were randomised with two parallel treatment arms. They were randomised 1-to-1. So patients were treated with spironolactone compared with placebo. They only included women over the age of 18, and they were either randomised to 50 milligrams of spironolactone for the first 6 weeks or matched placebo. And then after 6 weeks, they went to 100 milligrams of spironolactone or matched placebo until 24 weeks. So the primary outcome was the acne quality of life, but there were various secondary outcomes, and this included the investigator's global assessment, the IGA. So what were the main findings? Well, there were 410 participants included, so it's a big study. Almost half of them were recruited from social media, interestingly. At 12 weeks, the mean acne quality of life was 19.2 in the spironolactone group, and 17.8 in the placebo group, giving a mean difference of 1.27. At 24 weeks, the mean difference was higher, it was 3.5, and this was statistically significant. So using the IGA score, clinicians were significantly more likely to consider treatment as successful for participants in the spironolactone group at 12 weeks. Interestingly, the only difference that wasn't statistically significant was that of a participant's report of overall acne improvement at 12 weeks. But at 24 weeks, the difference was substantial and statistically significant. So is it applicable and what are the limitations? Well, it's a well-designed pragmatic RCT and it's a large study. They started at lower doses than what some clinicians may use, and they didn't increase beyond 100 milligrams, which some clinicians tend to go much over. There was no data on relapse after discontinuation, and they continued topical treatments throughout the trial in both arms. In terms of the take-home message, this is a randomized control trial of 420 women, which shows superiority of spironolactone over placebo. Changes were more pronounced at 6 months, and we don't know the relapse rate, but overall, it was well tolerated, and it's considered a safe and useful treatment for acne, particularly where isotretinoin cannot be used. So moving on to our second study. This was published in JAD, and this is Paroxetine is an effective treatment for refractory erythema of rosacea. Primary results from the prospective rosacea refractory erythema randomized control trial. So why did we choose this paper? Well, erythematotelangiectatic rosacea has limited treatment options. And this is a study that looked at the use of a widely used drug, paroxetine, to improve the erythema of rosacea. In terms of the study design, this was a multi-center randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled trial that included patients with a refractory erythema of rosacea, randomly assigned to receive paroxetine 25 milligrams daily or placebo for 12 weeks. So coming on to the results of the study, they included 97 patients who completed the study. The primary endpoint was clinical erythema assessment, and that was met. So it's a CEA success achieved with improved erythema for paroxetine versus placebo at week 12 compared to baseline. So the numbers were 42.9% versus 20.8%, and that's a significant p-value. A flushing improvement was also noted in the paroxetine group. 22 of 49 patients, so that's 44.9%, reported flushing success with point reductions, two or more, compared to baseline, and that was versus 12 or 48, so 25%. So just those numbers of 44.9% versus 25%, and that was again a significant result. There was no significant difference in inflammatory lesion counts or telangiectasia. Interestingly, the quality of life and depression, anxiety and stress scales, the ROSACL, which is the Rosacea Quality of Life score, that didn't differ between the two groups. And recurrence after improvement was noted in over a third of patients after paroxetine discontinuation. So limitations, is it applicable? Well, there's a short follow-up period and they only use a single dose of paroxetine. The study was conducted in China and they didn't give the ethnicity of participants. They didn't report that. What's the take-home message? Well, paroxetine is a commonly used antidepressant, which is generally considered a safe drug. This study shows improvement in erythema and flushing in those treated with paroxetine 25 milligrams for 12 weeks compared with placebo. The quality of life scores didn't differ between the two groups. With limited treatment options for erythema and rosacea, paroxetine may show some benefit and is a welcome addition. It may, however, need to be continued long term. So there have been a recent, quite a few number of publications on methotrexate. And our next paper looks at methotrexate monitoring. So this was risk stratified monitoring for methotrexate toxicity in immune-mediated inflammatory diseases, prognostic model development and validation using primary care data from the UK. So why did we choose this paper? Well, methotrexate is widely used, as we all know, and there's no evidence to support three-monthly blood tests. Previous studies have shown infrequent abnormal blood tests after the first year of methotrexate. And this study, which was published in the BMJ, looked at the frequency of blood tests for methotrexate monitoring. In terms of the study aim and design, this was a retrospective cohort study which looked at adult patients prescribed methotrexate from 2007 to 2019 by GPs. And data was used to develop a prognostic model and validate it. The outcome of interest was methotrexate discontinuation due to abnormal bloods. In terms of the main findings, data for 13,110 and 23,999 participants who contributed are included in this study. So in the development data set, 854 outcomes occurred in 6.5% of patients. Strong independent predictors were cytopenia or raised liver enzyme levels, or both in the 6 months before start of follow-up, chronic kidney disease stage 3 and diabetes. So this was what the authors concluded, that it seems reasonable to offer patients at relatively low risk, so having 10% risk score over 5 years, representing 68.4% of the validation cohort, 6 monthly or annual testing. So those with very low risk could reasonably have 6 months or annual testing, whereas those with moderate risk, which they said using the prognostic model could be between 10 to 20% risk over 5 years, that represented 20.9% of the validation cohort. These might continue with the current testing, which is every 3 months. And those who were high risk, so greater than 20% according to their risk model, and which represents about 10% of the validation cohort, those could undergo more frequent testing. In terms of limitations, most patients had rheumatoid arthritis and concurrent use of biologics was unknown. Also, the time of the first prescription hospital was unknown, and these were shared care prescriptions, which means that generally these would be lower risk patients than those treated in secondary care. But this is real world data, and this is a large data set with a validated cohort. So what's the take-home message? Well, I think it's time to rethink frequency of systemics testing. And this paper highlights the key predictors of discontinuation of methotrexate. And they've created a prediction model that they've validated with suggestions for infrequent testing in low-risk patients. So our interesting case for this edition is multinuclear cell angiohistiocytoma. And this is from a publication termed asymptomatic violaceous papules on the dorsal hand, and that was published in JAD case reports. So what is it? Well, multinuclear cell angiohistiocytoma is a rare vascular and fibrohistiocytic proliferation of unknown etiology. Lesions may present as localized, solitary or coalescing violaceous papules or plaques. They can occur on various locations, but the dorsi of the hands are particularly common. And the lesions are attributed to a reactive process as a result of chronic inflammation, and they're associated with increased dermal vascularity and fibrosis. It is a benign condition, but it rarely regresses spontaneously. And various things have been tried. Treatment options include surgical excision, intralesional steroids, often requiring multiple sessions, and lasers such as CO2 laser and the potassium titanyl phosphate.
The next paper is entitled Long-Term Neurocognitive Functioning of Children Treated with Propranolol or Atenolol for Infantile Hemangioma. And this was taken from the European Journal of Paediatrics. We chose this paper because propranolol has become the mainstay of treatment for complicated infantile hemangioma, but there have been concerns raised about potential CNS effects, which have been observed in adult studies. Atenolol is considered to have less CNS effects than propranolol, that there could be delayed cognitive effects in young children. Should we be counselling patients for this unclear risk? This study looked at long-term neurocognitive functioning using something called the Cognitive Proficiency Index, which is a measure including working memory, processing speed, and attention. They compared this between groups treated with either propranolol or atenolol for infantile hemangioma for at least 6 months' duration, who had started the treatment under the age of one. The children being assessed were at least age six, and if they'd received propranolol, it was at a dose of at least 2 milligrams per kilogram per day. So what did they find? Well, they assessed 105 children, of which 36 had received propranolol and 69 had received atenolol. There was no difference in the cognitive proficiency index between groups and no difference compared to normal values expected for the population. Notably, there were only 20 males in the entire group, but they had significantly lower scores than females and compared to population norms. So, what are the limitations of this study? Well, authors recognise that there may have been expectation bias influencing parental reporting at the assessment. The small number of males makes interpretation of their lower scores more complex, but apparently similar trends may have been observed in other smaller studies. So what's the take-home message? Well, it is reassuring that as a group, children who have been treated with either beta blocker as infants had had no long-term cognitive impact. It is helpful to know that despite crossing the blood-brain barrier, propranolol does not affect cognitive development compared to atenolol. The effect that was observed in males is concerning, but the numbers treated here are very small and larger studies are needed. For now, it's a good reminder to ensure that beta blockers are only used where clinically warranted, for example, when interfering with function or at high-risk sites. By Mr. Jamie Banks. It's entitled Patient-Reported Outcomes of Medical Tattooing for Capillary Malformations, and is taken from Dermatology. We chose this paper because it explores the use of medical tattooing instead of laser therapy for capillary malformations. Whilst tattooing has fulfilled other roles such as within reconstructive and oncological fields, it has not been well described in the treatment of capillary malformations, and we aim to highlight its therapeutic potential. This study aimed to investigate patient-reported outcomes of medical tattooing. It employed a retrospective design in the form of cross-sectional digital surveys, analysing data from 89 respondents who underwent medical tattooing. Patients' perceptions of the procedure's impact on their quality of life and psychosocial well-being were assessed. So what were the main findings? This study found that medical tattooing had positive effects on patients' quality of life and psychosocial well-being. Colour reduction of at least 75% was achieved in 37% of the overall cohort, reaching 61% in those aged over 35 years. The majority, 83% of participants, expressed satisfaction with the aesthetic outcomes of tattooing, with increased satisfaction amongst lighter skin types. The use of camouflage cream was significantly lower after tattooing. Top reported complications included transient pain, bleeding, and hypertrophic scarring. So in terms of limitations, these include retrospective study design and potential recall bias. The study focused solely on patient-reported outcomes, lacking objective clinical assessments. While the results suggest positive effects, further research is needed to validate the long-term efficacy and explore potential variations in outcomes across different patient groups, particularly in younger patients where previous studies correlate with the reduced perceived efficacy of medical tattooing treatment of capillary malformations, again demonstrated in this study. So what's the take-home message? This study highlights the favourable patient-reported outcomes of medical tattooing, showcasing its potential to enhance patients' quality of life and emotional well-being in the treatment of capillary malformations. However, due to study limitations, practitioners should consider these findings as part of a broader understanding of the procedure's impact on patients' lives. This year, there was a nice guideline update for the guideline on atopic eczema in the under-12s diagnosis and management. Here we're going to just summarise what's new. The key message that we should be aware of is that in secondary care, GPs won't be able to prescribe bath additives based on the advice, do not offer emollient bath additives to children with atopic eczema. Additional changes to the guidance include suggesting that a choice of unperfumed emollients should be offered, either a combination of products or one product for all purposes. If their current emollient causes irritation or is not acceptable, offer a different way to apply it or offer an alternative emollient. Children should apply emollients and other treatments such as steroids one product at a time and then wait several minutes before applying the next product, but they can choose which product to apply first. It's also suggested that GPs should offer personalised advice on washing with emollients or emollient soap substitutes and leave-on emollients which can be added to the bath water. Children younger than 12 months old should use leave-on emollients instead of shampoos, and older children should shampoo using a brand that is unperfumed and ideally labelled as suitable for eczema. They should also avoid washing their hair in the bath water. Firstly, efficacy of a clinical decision rule to enable direct oral challenge in patients with low-risk penicillin allergy, the PALLAS randomised clinical trial. This was taken from JAMA Internal Medicine. So we know that less than 5% of people who are labelled with a penicillin allergy are in fact truly allergic. And in dermatology, we're often at the front line of managing drug reactions. The current gold standard of care involves skin prick testing, followed by a direct oral challenge if skin prick testing is negative. But clearly, this is resource intensive, and therefore many people will remain inappropriately diagnosed with penicillin allergy. This was a parallel, non-inferiority, open-label, multi-centre, international, randomised controlled trial. It compared the intervention arm, which was direct oral challenge, versus skin prick testing and then direct oral challenge in the control arm. Only adults with a low risk of allergy were included. This was assessed using the recognised and validated PENFAST score, and so only patients with a score less than 3 were included. Just to shortly dwell on how this is calculated, it's an easy to find score online and it gives a weighted score based on the presence or absence of the following parameters: 5 years or less since the reaction, anaphylaxis or angioedema, or a severe cutaneous adverse reaction, or treatment required for reaction. In this study, 377 patients were included. Most of these had a PENFAST score of only 0 or 1. One patient in each arm had a doctor-confirmed immune reaction within 1 hour of direct oral challenge, and this made up 0.5% of each group. So we're told that the one-sided 95% confidence interval was below the non-inferiority margin, which had been set at 5 percentage points. They tell us that in the 5 days post-direct oral challenge, 9 immune-mediated adverse events were recorded in the intervention group and 10 in the control group, so very comparable. No serious adverse events occurred in either arm. Therefore, authors conclude that in low-risk scenarios, direct oral challenge with penicillin is appropriate and safe. The sample here was large enough to provide reasonable reassurance on this. This was entitled Differences Between Aquagenic and Non-Aquagenic Pruritus in Myeloproliferative Neoplasms, an observational study of 500 patients, and this was taken from the JEADV. So we know that pruritus is common amongst patients with myeloproliferative neoplasms, especially aquagenic pruritus. Here, nearly 1,500 questionnaires were distributed to just over 500 patients with myeloproliferative neoplasms, of which just over half had essential thrombocythemia. And the next most common group was polycythemia vera, followed by 7.9% primary myelofibrosis. They received these questionnaires before consultations to assess the clinical incidence of pruritus. Pruritus was reported in nearly 50% of the patients. Patients who were suffering from pruritus had a higher rate of evolution into myelofibrosis and acute myeloid leukemia, with a rate of 19.5% in those with pruritus versus only 9% in those without. Patients with aquagenic pruritus had the highest pruritus intensity values and a higher rate of evolution than patients with non-aquagenic pruritus. Ruxolitinib and hydroxyurea were the most effective drugs to reduce aquagenic pruritus intensity in this group. In conclusion, pruritus is common and burdensome amongst all patients with myeloproliferative neoplasms, irrespective of the subtype, and it is an indicator of potential progression to higher-risk disease. Aquagenic pruritus is particularly problematic for patients and is associated with a higher risk of evolution. We hope you enjoyed Dermatology Snapshots this month. Don't forget to sign up through our website if you haven't done so already, and we'll see you next month.